Okay, let's open up to Genesis chapter 11. And we're moving right along. We're getting towards the end of the fourth Toledot, which we noted began in chapter 10, verse 1, the generations of Noah's son, generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then that section runs all the way through chapter 11, verse 9, and that's what we're going to cover today is verse 1 through 9 of chapter 11. So this is we're getting towards the end. As we talked about before, you know, there's two key ways of dividing up Genesis. Number one is based on the Toledots, the generations of. There's 10 divisions of Genesis based on that. But then another way to look at Genesis and outline it, we've talked about this before too, is we kind of have that primeval history. Primeval means early age. So we kind of have the early section, which would be Genesis 1 through 11, again, the four great events. And then we go into, that'll transition then into the patriarchal history, where we focus on the four great men, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But obviously we're getting towards the end of the primeval history here with the tower account in Genesis chapter 11. And this then will move us, the Tower of Babel then moves us right into the next Toledot, which will be the generations of Shem, which starts in chapter 11, verse 10. And that will carry us right up to the time of Abraham and the patriarchal history section of Genesis, which is most of the book, you know, chapter 12 through 50, focuses on the descendants of Abraham. And chapter 11, verse 1 through 9, we're going to take a little step back because we've looked at, in chapter 10, we looked at the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth and how these different nations developed and all of that. In chapter 11, we're going to take a step back to see how, you know, the why and how these nations developed. You know, everybody was kind of together after the flood. Everybody's kind of, you know, around Ararat where the ark landed. And so now we've got this dispersion going on. So what led to that dispersion? And Genesis chapter 11 addresses that for us. There's a Genesis chapter 11, you know, flows right out of chapter 10, and I think it's important to remember that, you know, the chapter divisions and the verses, that was all added, you know, 500 years ago. That was not part of the inspired word of God. So when we're reading, you know, we come down to verse 32, these are the families of the sons of Noah according to their generations. Then we move right into chapter 1, now the whole earth had the same language. So it really flows together. They're really connected. And it's important to note that sometimes the chapter divisions can kind of create a disconnection where there isn't really supposed to be one. And that would be the case particular in this account. So, and again, this marks a turning point from the universal history of mankind to the specific history of one family, Abraham and his descendants. Like chapter 6, chapter 11 begins with a tragic rebellion, with man's sin, and it ends with judgment. You know, the flood destroyed sinful men, but it didn't destroy the sin nature. And we saw that in the actions of Noah. You know, he was drunk in the vineyard, unclothed, and then we saw that in his son Ham, who treated him in a very disrespectful way. So let's go ahead and dig in with verse 1. Now the whole earth had the same language, and the same words. And it happened as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. So the all of the earth's post-flood population, as, you know, the population begins to increase, everybody spoke one language. They were united by one common language. And that word for language means literally lips. So they were united by one lip. They spoke the same words. They had one speech, I think some of the translations put it. And one of the commentators noted that up until the middle of the 19th century, it was always just kind of assumed that Hebrew was that one common language that everybody spoke. And there's some support for that, like we've talked about kind of the Hebrew word plays in Genesis, and those show up every now and then, particularly related to names like Adam came from the word Adamah, which means earth. So kind of those kinds of connections in Hebrews. Eve comes from the word for life. You know, if you're reading in English, Eve and life don't seem to match at all. But in Hebrew, Eve comes from the word for life. So there's some Hebrew-isms that occur that we don't pick up in English. So it kind of makes sense that the original language was Hebrew to work in all these word plays that come to emphasize certain points. So that makes some sense, but there's no way to know, was Hebrew the original language? You know, it doesn't say it was. There's some, makes sense that maybe it was, and there is some support for that. But we'll kind of just leave that there. So anyway, this united group, speaking the same language, using the same words, they journey east. And remember, the ark would have landed in the area of Ararat, which would have been like modern, and on the modern map, kind of eastern Turkey, western Armenia, kind of in that area. So from there, they went east and be kind of more sort of southeast to get to Shinar, where they're going to end up. But they're traveling along. And also, too, if you have ESV or New King James, there's sort of an alternate. Instead of saying, as they journeyed east, it has they journeyed from the east. So there's a little bit of controversy. Were they journeying to the east or journeying from the east? And there's no way to really sort that out. I think that the east, you know, whether going from the east or journeying east, it'd be kind of the same thing. They're going to end up in the plain of in Shinar. But another thing, too, we've talked about before is that term east, that direction, does seem to symbolize in some places separation from God's presence. And we'll see that in a couple of places as we walk through. Well, we've seen it already in the expulsion from the garden. You know, where were the cherubim placed? You know, at the east gate. So Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden. They were kicked out of God's presence in place of blessing and favor. And that all happened on the east. And then in chapter 4, verse 16, when Cain commits his sin and he's exiled, you know, where does he go? He goes to Nod, which is east of Eden. So kind of that whole east thing. And we'll see that too in Lot's choice, you know, when he separates from Abraham in chapter 13, you know, Lot chooses Sodom as his place to go, which is to the east. So we'll talk about that again when we get there. But just kind of that whole idea of just being out of God's presence and blessing. And that's the case with the people here as they journey to the east. And so they end up in verse 2 in the land of Shinar. And we talked about Shinar back in chapter 10. Verse 10 talks about the land of Shinar. It's south central, sort of that southern central area of Mesopotamia, you know, where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers kind of join together, and it's that plain between those two rivers. So it's a very fertile area that can support a lot of people. So it kind of makes sense that they go to where the good, you know, if all this had happened in the U.S., you know, they might go to Nebraska because we have a lot of fertile soil, so you can support people and grow your crops and graze your cattle and that kind of stuff. And the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which are mentioned periodically in Genesis, they're apparently named after the Tigris and Euphrates rivers that were part of Eden. They wouldn't be the same rivers because the whole geography of the earth was changed, but it's just like, you know, we're named, you know, there's certain names in the U.S. that maybe are named after, like the river, I think there's a River Thames in New York. Well, that's obviously named after the River Thames in England. They're not the same river. So it's the same kind of thing here, the Tigris and Euphrates terms that were brought into the post-flood world and applied to those two rivers. But again, that's kind of a key area regarding early human history, the land of Shinar, that area between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. So, and then verse 2, they settled there. And that word settled means to sit, remain, dwell. And I think NASB has a note, it's also translated dwelt. And the idea here is that they're taking up permanent residence. Okay, they're settling down. They don't want to travel anymore. You know, they're one big, large, happy family living together in close proximity. They found a good place to settle. So they're just stopping. And so basically they're resisting God's clear and repeated command that we see to multiply and fill the earth. Fill the earth doesn't mean you settle in one place. It means you go out and you subdue. You have dominion. God gave mankind dominion over the earth. And the command was, back to Adam in chapter 1, verse 28, it's to multiply and fill the earth. And then he reiterated that command back in chapter 9, verse 1 and 7. He reiterates that same command then to Noah and his sons, you know, go out and fill the earth. Well, here we have an incident now where they're not, the mankind at large here is not obeying that command. Okay, verse 3. Then they said to one another, come, let us bake bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and they had tar for mortar. And they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth. So here we have the building of Babel, Babylon, and kind of the enthusiastic backing for this massive project. Everybody's in agreement. That doesn't mean every single individual. There may have been some other groups off somewhere else, but the vast majority of the people living at that time, this is where we want to be, okay, and we want to settle. And so they have, you know, in complete disregard for God, you know, they initiate this building of their own empire. Then the building materials are there, they're hardened bricks. And, you know, this would be important. Remember, the children of Israel are reading this during the wilderness wandering. That's when Moses wrote Genesis. And there's a lot of stone in the Promised Land and in Egypt, so everything was built with stone. But in Mesopotamia, there's no stone. Okay, there's lots of clay. And so that's the building material they have to use there. And so they use hardened bricks. They're burned, or some translations say baked. But again, the clay is readily available, and that's what they build these structures out of. And it's these hardened bricks are joined with tar, you know, kind of an asphalty type stuff that's obviously plentiful in the Middle East, in that area, in the area of current Iraq. And then verse 4 again, and they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth. So again, their determination to build and establish a permanent residence, you know, this high-handed rebellion against God. And this effort was likely led by Nimrod. We studied Nimrod a couple weeks ago when we were in Genesis chapter 10 and the sons of Ham. Again, back in verse chapter 10, verse 8. Cush was the father of Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahweh. So he had this great reputation for being a great hunter. He's going to have a reputation for being a great builder. Verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. So that's where we're at now in Genesis chapter 11. So the general, you connect the two together, and it's likely that Nimrod was the leader of this effort to build up this city. And I think it's Josephus, yeah, said that it was Nimrod, who excited them to such an affront and contempt of God. So that's kind of a common thought, is that it's Nimrod who led the effort. And we see God's common grace at work here too, that the advances of mankind, you know. We'll get more into dating things when we get to the next, down in verse 10 and following, get to the next genealogy. We'll get some dates and things because they carry some dates there. But we're probably 100-200 years after the flood by this time. Again, I'll take a clearer position on that when we get into the next section. But in this amount of time, they've developed this expertise. They're able to build. I guess, you know, Noah obviously had good building skills with the ark. But again, God's common grace in bestowing on man the ability to do all these amazing things. It made me think of like today, like talking about a mission to Mars. It's like just God's common grace on giving mankind the ability to do these things. Okay, and then the top of this tower going to reach into heaven. Now, we noted before in chapter 1, you know, heaven is used in several different ways. That word heaven is sometimes translated heaven, but the same exact word is also translated sky. So in chapter 1, when it talks about the birds in the heavens or the birds in the sky, it's the same word. So obviously the birds don't live in the abode of God. They're on the earth in the as. So we have kind of the atmospheric heavens. Then we have the stellar heavens where the planets are. And then we have the abode of God, you know, the heavens where God is. So you got to kind of sort some of that out when you're looking at something like this. But it's probably a hyperbolic language, exaggerating to make a point. Their goal is to make this tower as tall as they possibly can. And likely, in their disregard for God, they want to have access. You know, look what we can do. You know, we're going to have access. You know, God's up there, but we're going to be up there too. Kind of the idea. But there are surviving. We call them ziggurats. They're kind of like the Egyptian pyramids. But they're staged, you know, they have the stairs going up to the top. And there are surviving ziggurats from Babylonia. I think the tallest one has been found is 300 feet tall, which would be about the observation deck on the state capitol. So they were able to build these pretty massive structures. And likely this one that they're building in, that we're reading about now, that they're building here was the prototype for all the other ziggurats that were built throughout Babylonia in ancient times that are in the process of being excavated. And usually these ziggurats that have been unearthed are topped by the very top is a place of worship, would be kind of a common use on the top. There's a lot of speculation as to the purpose of this particular tower. There's no particular support from the context, so we don't know. It's just one of those speculation things. But it was maybe the beginning of astrological worship of the heavenly bodies. So they wanted to get up as high as they could to worship the sun. So that's a thought that somebody had. It might be an attempt to escape another flood. Hey, if God brings another flood, we'll get on top of the ziggurat and we'll be safe. Maybe part of the city's defensive system, you know, kind of their hope for security. And it's in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 28, where the intimidated Israelites are describing their enemy, the Canaanites, and they're all freaked out. And like their cities are large and fortified to heaven, is what's said there. So again, that idea that building this tall structure is part of a fortification. But again, we don't really know exactly what the purpose of the tower was here in Babel. All we know is that it was a defiance of God's command to disperse. It was part of their, let's focus here, let's build here, let's build these big structures. We're not moving anywhere. Good fields, good city. We'll just stay here. And again, their goal here is fame and renown and security and self-sufficiency apart from God. Says here, make a name for ourselves. And there's some of that Hebrew wordplay in that word name. We talked about that back when we were looking at the descendants of Shem. But Shem and name are the same Hebrew word. So and we talked about back in chapter 9, verse 26, that Yahweh makes himself a name in being the God of Shem. So and that's where the messianic line is going to come from, where God is going to manifest himself more clearly. So likely kind of a connection there in Hebrew, again, that we wouldn't pick up in English. And another connection with this word name is it's basically the same word translated there. So we see the word there used five different times in this text. And so the Hebrew word for name is Shem, and the Hebrew name for there is Sham. So you got the Shem, Sham, Shem, Sham kind of going back and forth, which if you're reading it in Hebrew, you'd pick up on it. You know, we don't pick up on it in English, but then it gives an emphasis on this is where we want to be, there, you know. We're making a name, we're making a Shem for ourselves by being in the Sham. So, again, kind of an interesting interplay of connection of words. But again, the emphasis here is this is the geographic location where we want to be. We don't care what God says, and so we're going to set up shop here and stay here. And then again, and still in verse 4, they don't want to be scattered over the face of the earth, dispersed over the face of the earth. They want unity and security and fame, and you know, in defiance of God's plan to fill the earth, you know, and establish their own rule and authority and do things on their own. One commentator noted, and I think this is really good, that it really kind of mirrors the events in Eden. You know, Eve wanted wisdom and defied God to get it. And where did she end up? It wasn't good. The same thing here. They want power and strength and unity, and they'll defy God in order to achieve that. And again, no thought to the consequences. Verse 5. Then Yahweh, so now God's actions here. Then Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And Yahweh said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they have begun to do. So now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them." So here we have, you know, God here is Yahweh instead of Elohim, again emphasizing his personal and direct involvement in human affairs. We've talked about that before. You know, Yahweh is his personal covenant name. God, Elohim, is more his, emphasizes more his power and transcendent authority. So here we're looking at his, you know, he's coming down, his personal involvement with mankind here, and looking forward ultimately to the coming covenant with Abraham that we're going to be seeing, you know, in just a chapter or two. But God's, you know, reaction is he came down. And again, him coming down, I mean, he's omnipresent. He's everywhere all the time. So it's not like he has to come down in order to see what's going on. But this is anthropomorphic language, you know, kind of giving God kind of human traits to help us understand more about what's going on here. It really emphasizes his involvement and his preparation for action. So he's coming down, he's there, and he's ready to act is really the picture. I liked one of the commentators, Matthews, I said it's quite the irony, you know, mankind is building this great project. Well, what does God have to do? He has to come down to see it. Kind of this comparatively tiny venture. You know, man, sometimes we think we're so grandiose and building this and building that, and God's like coming down, this puny little thing that they're building. I liked, he said that Matthews, one of the commentators I use, he says, it's a tiny tower conceived by a puny plan and attempted by a pint-sized people. So again, just kind of hitting it, you know, the lack of humility of the people of Babylon. And Psalm chapter 2, verse 4 really talks about God's attitude towards, you know, these types of pathetic mortal schemes. You know, he sits in the heavens and laughs. You know, the God, the Lord mocks them. You know, and it's the same thing. I mean, you can see that today so clear. The nations do these things. The United Nations does these things. Oh, we're going to be good. No need for a God. But God's just up there laughing and saying, these puny, you know, people that have no idea how things are unfolding. I'm the one in control. I'm going to bring things to pass the way I want. You can do whatever you want to try to stop that, but it's a futile effort. And that's exactly what we have going on in Babylon. It's a very futile effort on the part of these people to disregard God's commands. You know, there's a question too, getting back in verse 6, into verse 5, it says, the tower which the sons of men had built. There's a little bit of controversy. Did God allow the city and the tower to come to complete completion? You know, were they totally done when he came down? And there's a little bit of difference in the Hebrew. The Hebrew verb there can be taken a little differently. Instead of saying that it was completed, it can also be translated, and a couple of translations do this. He came down in verse 5. He came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men were building. It can also be translated, the sons of men had started building, or it could be translated, the sons of men had built. All of those are equally allowable in the grammar. And I think down at the end of, let's go down to verse 8. At the end of verse 8, when God scatters them, they stopped building the city. So if you take that back into verse 5, it seems like maybe the city hadn't actually been completed yet. Okay, he came down and stopped what's going on. Again, just a little aside. It's a result of too much reading. Okay, verse 6. And Yahweh said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they have begun to do. So now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them." Again, so Yahweh's assessment, you know, this one people united by one language, sinful goals and ambitions. Again, we talked about how the flood didn't solve man's sin problem. The flood only killed sinners. So the future is very bleak if they're allowed to continue with this effort. And again, very similar to back to the sin in Genesis. You know, if when we get to Genesis 3 and the curse, and what's one thing that God says? He's, you know, fearful, or he's makes the observation that they might take from the tree of life and eat and live forever. So after the sin, what does God do? He kicks Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden so they won't take that fruit and live forever in their fallen state. And we kind of have a similar situation here where God's, one language, you know, living in a garden with all this free stuff sounds really good. You know, all together, united, building the city sounds really good, but it's not good. So kind of a similar thing. They're going to be expelled, scattered from Babylon. And God's going to deal with this problem before it gets worse. So fragmentation is going to be better than this collective apostasy where they just continue to defy God. You know, in mercy, God doesn't allow their sin to go to the extent like it did with the flood. You know what happened with the flood? Mankind became so evil that the intervention was to kill everybody but eight. You know, he doesn't let that, or he doesn't, his plan doesn't include that here. His plan is going to be to stop the apostasy, to stop the sinfulness of man before it reaches that point, so he can maintain mankind and continue his plan for humanity. So verse 7, come. So again, this is God's action here. So he's assessed things, and now his plan of action. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's language. So Yahweh scattered them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. So again, here we have Yahweh's response and action. That us, that divine plural, we've seen that before in chapter 1, verse 26, and in chapter 3, verse 22. You know, God uses the us to express the fullness of divine power. Lots of times we'll refer to it as a plural of majesty, you know, like the queen says, let us. But she's talking about herself. She's the one in charge. And kind of that same sort of idea. It also allows for the future revelation of the triune God in the New Testament. So I don't know that, you know, that in the Old Testament, they didn't understand anything about the triunity of God. But this would certainly allow for that through progressive revelation later on. So again, knowing what the end result of their actions would be, God strikes at the heart of their unity. And that's their language. You know, a common language, that's a very uniting factor. So he confuses their language. That word confuse means to mingle, mix, confuse, confound. In other words, they couldn't understand each other. It was would have been kind of an interesting sight to have been able to see this. Where all of a sudden, we're all talking together, and then all of a sudden, no. It's like, what are you saying? What is that? You know, nobody knows what happened. You just can't understand each other any longer. I like in Psalm chapter 55, verse 9, one of David's imprecatory prayers, you know, to curses, you know, that God would react against his enemies. And it says here in chapter 55, verse 9, confuse, O Lord, divide their tongues. So if you want to really harm a group of people, you divide their language. You make it so they can't understand one another. So again, the result of this, you know, they can't understand each other's language, is that's going to result in the scattering. Because if we can't understand each other, okay, maybe I can understand, you know, Tom and Gus and Marilyn, but I can't understand anybody else. And so we divide up into these groups would be the natural outcome of this division of language. And the different groups kind of go their own way because they can't understand or communicate with anybody else. So this, again, this common bond of language was lost. And it's interesting, some people say God doesn't want cities, but that's not really the case because he doesn't destroy the city. He just destroys the common bond of language that the people have. And again, God's mercy, not allowing the human race to reach the point of sin where he has to destroy it again like he did in the flood. And, you know, kind of, as you're thinking through this, it kind of makes you think of Pentecost a little bit, but in reverse. In Pentecost, there's all these different languages that nobody can hear, and all of a sudden they're getting a similar message, you know. The gospel is being spread there as people are supernaturally enabled. The apostles are. They're supernaturally enabled to speak all these languages in a unified way. And it makes you look forward. Well, I like, too, Galatians chapter 3, verse 28. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither slave nor free man. There is no male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. You know, we're moving from here, we have this you know, dispersion, but we're moving back towards a unity that we see in the church. You know, we're unified in the church regardless of language, race, all those things, political views. Well, maybe not political views, but we're all, we're all united despite these differing opinions that we might have in different languages, but we're all united. And that would picture the way things were before the dispersion at Babel. And it pictures what things will be like in the future, you know, in the kingdom. It's all people are going to be united. Whether we'll speak one language, I don't know that, but we'll be united in a way that will be amazing. Okay, verse 9. So, therefore, its name was called Babel, because there Yahweh confused the language of the whole earth. And from there, Yahweh scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So, again, now the city is derisively named Babel. And here we have one of those Hebrew word plays again, where Babel sounds just like that word we saw confuse back in chapter 7. They're pretty much the same exact word. You wouldn't pick up on that at all in English, but in Hebrew, the name Babel is Babel. It's just transliterated for us, but the name confuse is Balal. So you have Babel and Balal, so they really come together there. So they get the exact opposite, the people of Babylon get the exact opposite of what they wanted. They came in speaking one language, wanted to all be there. Now all of a sudden their languages are confused and they have to separate. One thing too, this was kind of interesting, but in ancient Akkadian, you know, one of the ancient languages of the early peoples, the word for Babel is gateway of the gods. So Babylon becomes this great city. But, you know, in Hebrew, it's a derisive term. And in Akkadian, you know, language of many of the early non-believers, it's gateway of the gods. So we kind of see just a disparity there. Okay, so we're kind of come full circle from Eden to Babylon. You know, in Eden, they're expelled from the garden, and here they're expelled from Babylon as part of God's plan for human history. And I think there's a clear lesson in this, you know, a warning for Israel of Moses today. Remember, Israel is receiving this, Moses is writing it. And I think the point here is that to survive as a nation, Israel has to obey God's will or face judgment. So Israel had this message of Babylon, and what does Israel do? You know, what do they do over time? They refuse to obey the Lord. And so what happens to them? They're scattered. You know, scattered for 2,000 years at one point. So, and that's just the ongoing legacy of the nation Israel because of their refusal. They're just like what happened to Babylon. They've been scattered. So we'll go ahead and stop there. We'll pick up on some more details regarding the tower incident and where it fits into the history as we move through the genealogy of the generations of Shem, which is where we'll start next time in verse 10. And that carries us for 10 generations from Shem down to Abraham, or Abram. And then God's selecting that one family out of all the families of the earth through which to do his work on earth. So we have a couple of minutes if anybody has any comments or questions.
So what happened to the Tower of Babel? If it was that big, wouldn't it still be there somewhere?
Yeah, the question was, what happened to the Tower of Babel? Now, most things from that time frame don't last. They're destroyed through various, you know, through various things. So they've found some, you know, some ziggurats have been well preserved, but not very many. So, but good question. Yeah, a lot of the ancient cultures, buildings just crumble and decay. And I mean, they were made of baked bricks, not stone. It's a little different than the pyramids. So no, they would have decayed. But good question. Anything else, Norm?
I thought it was interesting, the note on the verse 6. And Yahweh said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language, and this is what they began to do. So now nothing they purpose to do will be withheld from them.
Yeah, there's some translations say withheld, and some say impossible. And there was another. Yeah, there's another.
I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, right, exactly. It carried the same idea that there's nothing that they won't be able to do. You know, God, unless He intervenes, they're going to just keep going. I mean, He made us, made mankind to be creative, and God. There's nothing that would have been withheld from them if He didn't intervene. Their accomplishments would have carried them up to the point where the world was before the flood. So,
11:1. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. I don't know. When I first became a believer, I thought maybe I was taught this. I don't know that it was just one language, but actually they were using the same language. Right?
Yeah.
But they had their own native tongue.
Yeah.
Because it's like English. Most of the world uses English now.
Yeah, it was like
their, that's not their native tongue.
Yeah, it's, you know, when there would have been one language with Noah and his and the kids, so they would have started with one language. So there is some debate, were there other languages at this time or not? You know, it's no way to really know for sure, but it makes good sense that, you know, the population is probably, I read estimates from 3,000 to 10,000 by this time, so it wouldn't have been huge yet because not enough generations had passed. So there is a good chance they were all still speaking one language, that's all there was. And then the languages come into existence. I think I was reading there's 7,000 languages identified in the world today, but they all come from 22 language families. So, and I think there's 150, you know, linguists, scientists doing studies on things. You know, there's 22 language families, 150 branches, and then 7,000 languages come from all that. But it would have all started here. You know, maybe the Table of Nations in chapter 10, there's 70 nations. So it might make sense that 70 languages, you know, were created here. And that's why we have the 70 nations over in chapter 10, because chapter 11, verse 1 through 9 precedes most of what we saw in chapter 10. So we'd have these 70 languages that then, or these 70 nations, each speaking a different language. That's why they're a nation. They got together. And then from there, you know, people isolate, so additional languages are born. I don't know if you've ever been down south, you know, and somebody, hi, oh, what's up? And I'm like, okay, they're speaking English, but I don't quite understand it all that well. But, you know, just different parts of the world where even the same language can develop into two separate languages over time. So maybe started with the 70, and those 70 over time, just through isolation and different dialects, have developed into the 7,000 that we see today. And that would be, you know, theoretically possible. So, but yeah, there's a lot of questions. I was talking with Steve, I was saying, you know, one thing in going through Genesis is trying to decide what not to teach, because I do all this reading, and it's just so interesting. You just keep diving in and diving in, and then it's like, I better not go off on that rabbit trail, or... But it helps when I get a good question about it. So, okay, one more.
When you mentioned the mission to Mars, I couldn't help but kind of think, was that just kind of a modern Tower of Babel? I mean, do we really need a mission to Mars, or is that just to show that?
Yeah, I think that's a big piece of it. It's just to demonstrate man's pride. Look what we want to do and can do and stuff. And same way Mission to Mars is now. And they probably talked about the tower for a while. Hey, let's build a big tower. You know, and then a year or two later, they decide, let's start now. But yeah, good point. Okay, let's go ahead and thank you for your attention and thank you for your good questions. Let's close in prayer. So dear Father, again, we want to just praise you and thank you for this time together. Just thank you, Father, for the clarity of your word. Thank you for demonstrating, showing us so clearly the sinfulness of mankind. And our need for you, our need to obey you and follow you and submit to you for our own good. We know that you have a perfect love for us, and we just need to trust you and do what you say. We just pray, Father, for the sermon to follow. Can we pray that your Holy Spirit would move among us to help us understand clearly what your word has to say. In Jesus' name, amen.